Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August the 24th, 1995. In the fireside room this evening, we're going to be listening to Dion Struthman. His subject, sustainability, put the future on the front burner, not the back burner. Let's listen in.
My name is Dion Struthman, and I think most of you now have tolerated me at least once or twice in this week, but one or two people who are new, and I want to welcome all of you. Tonight's session is on sustainability, putting the future on the front burner instead of on the back burner, and for the most part, the comments that I'm going to make have to do with agriculture, although in a lot of cases, with some customizing, the principles could be applied to some broader topics. Just a little bit of background in a specific sort of way as far as this topic is concerned. I told most of you the other night that I was born and raised on a couple of farms in northeast Nebraska. And I still remember my father, and my mother just reminded me not long ago of occasionally when my father would, we would be driving along, and he would make some comment about the fact that this particular farmer was not doing things very well because a lot of his topsoil was moving from where it was to more towards the bottom, and that there were ways suggested that there were ways to do something about that, but obviously this particular producer didn't want to. He was also very careful with his animals, and as a result, most of the time, his animals didn't misbehave. Once in a while, there was one that would do things he didn't want. But I would say, by and large, from what I can remember, he had much less trouble with his livestock than what others did. And my sense is it's because they responded to the treatment that he gave them. And in one sense, that's a good bit about what sustainable agriculture is all about. In my first session, I talked about, gave you some of the suggestions, statements, and so forth from Professor Stoltz from the Pacific Lutheran, either university or seminary. I'm not sure. She may be actually affiliated with both. At any rate, she suggests that with regard to creation, that we should spend more time on the fall and the curses associated with the fall. And then talked about six broken relationships. Tonight, basically, what I would like to do is to focus on three of those relationships, and that is, three. Among humans, again, because we're going to talk a little bit about the farming situation and agriculture, and then we're going to talk about rural communities. And I'll make the point, I hope, that they are not the same thing. We will also talk about humans and animals, and we will also talk about humans and Earth. And as you remember, she suggested that the current sort of Christology mainly emphasized the broken relationship of God and humans, and she suggested that it be enlarged or broadened to take in all of the relationships. And again, as I say, I want to bring into focus three of those relationships tonight. again, as most of you know, I was a late and, as I put it last time, an uncertain addition to the teaching staff, and as a result, I didn't get a chance to give the bookstore some suggestions, but some of you have already seen this. This is a publication that was published by an organization that I was president of during that time. It is not one that I would, the points of which I would endorse in many cases, but so be it in that sense.
Then why do you mention it?
Well, because I want to, I guess what I want to do is to indicate to all of you in a general sort of way that there are views out there among people in my profession which are quite different than mine. I don't want you to have the notion that everybody agrees with me. I'm sure you'd know that anyway, but just as a way of giving some balance and so forth, because basically this, the approach in this is to say that, and the title is How Much Land Can 10 Billion People Spare for Nature, is that if we utilize all the technology that we have in a sort of all-out kind of effort, that we can produce enough food for 10 billion people, not use up any more land area than we do right now, and we can keep the same amount of land, quote-unquote, for nature. I just don't happen to believe that, but anyway, one of the reasons I don't believe it is because of this publication, which was published by the same organization a little bit earlier, Water Quality, Agriculture's Role. And a little bit later we'll touch on this, just for now to say that those of us in agriculture in many cases now recognize that agriculture is the prime source of non-point water pollution. We in agriculture. It's taken us a while. Other people were telling us that for some time.
You said you were the prime source of
non-point.
Non-point?
Yeah, that means you can't actually point the finger at some specific thing and say, you polluted that.
Oh, okay.
In the words,
there's no sewer pipe.
Soil in the river. And it comes from this farm, that farm, and a whole bunch of other farms. Or animal waste from this feedlot, that feedlot, and so on. Another related publication is from the same organization, different authors, is one on wetland policy issues. What we've done, what they did in this issue was really to try to present the best case for both sides. And both sides, one being the private property rights, it's kind of getting its more than its fair share right now, perhaps, in this whole issue. And the other one has to do with the fact that in the case of wetlands, we're talking about public resources, natural resources. And this publication really does try to present the best case for both points of view. Just very recent, and I'll refer to it again, is this publication, again by the same organization, the Conservation Reserve Program. Some of you may recognize the acronym CRP. On the other hand, if you don't, why, that's what it is, the Conservation Reserve Program. What this is, just recently published, is a survey of about 20 agriculturally related, and that's in its broadest context, organizations and members thereof, with a series of questions trying to assess their attitudes as to whether or not the Conservation Reserve Program should be included in the next Farm Bill. It's kind of interesting reading. It gives the intent of the organization is, in fact, to bring science to these kinds of policy debates in Washington. And this is a particularly well-focused, appropriate publication, and it's also very timely. Here's something that some of you might be familiar with, the World Watch organization. This is a little pamphlet on jobs and a sustainable economy, and this is something that could go beyond agriculture, but I'll also talk a little bit about that. Something that, just based on the title, Food for the Future, and then the subtitle, Conditions and Contradictions of Sustainability. And basically, that's a very good description of what's inside, something that if you're particularly interested in the contradiction or the possible dilemma of moving towards a more sustainable, and then some people would say, less productive agriculture. How are we going to feed the people, or how are we going to maintain production? And then something that's a specific kind of, again, some research done in a survey form with, actually what it is to compare pairs of producers in Montana, North Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, perhaps another state. A producer who considered him or herself sustainable, and one who considered themselves conventional. And they tried to make the, other than that, they tried to make the situations roughly comparable, and then ultimately did an examination, evaluation of both of the pairs, including financial, to the point of getting tax records and so forth from the participants. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the things in here as well. Finally, if I would have driven all the way out here from St. Paul, Minnesota, I would have come through some area that there's a story in this bulletin of the Agriculture Research Service, which is the research arm of the USDA. It actually talks about an animal research project, pasture range research efforts, mainly in Montana, having to do with scientists seek rangeland sustainability. And if you follow that kind of thing at all, you'll know that from time to time it's a relatively hot topic, having to do with what fees we charge, the government charges being the cattle producers in this part of the world. I'm going to save this book for a little later in terms of actually sharing a little bit with you, but this is Agricultural Policy and the Environment, Iron Fist or Open Hand, and you can use your imagination to conjure up whatever images you might want to. Then this organization that did a number of these publications in January had its first major conference in Washington, which we had about 250 people, many of them from Washington, policymakers, staff makers, a few congressmen. One of the keynote speakers was Richard Lugar, and had we not chosen the night of the State of the Union address, that would have been on C-SPAN, but it's kind of hard to compete. Furthermore, we didn't want to pay the bill for moving the lights around after the thing. So we missed that opportunity, but we did put this together. One of the things, and this really talks about sustainable agriculture and tries to tie it to the various issues that ought to be dealt with in the new Farm Bill, the one that will probably be finished yet this year. One of the things in here that I'm particularly pleased with and had a part in was to talk about the role of and the sort of fragile nature of rural communities, and worked hard at making the point that the things that we might consider useful for agriculture, production agriculture, may or may not actually benefit rural communities, and they are not one and the same thing. I'll go into it a little bit more so that I can remove frowns on people's faces if you have one. Don't worry about it. Then what I want to do tonight actually is, I've identified a number of points that are going to get very short attention because we don't have very much time, but there are particular topics or issues that are important in the general notion of sustainable agriculture, and in many cases either the actual reality of it or in some cases the politics of agriculture, politics of farm policy, and as we hopefully move towards a whole effort that's more sustainable. And first in this book is a nice little couple of sentences in there that really, in one sense, capture. Some of you may have real trouble trying to kind of catch all the nuances about the various terminologies and so forth and so on. And let me try to help in one way. As he says in the book, environmentalists use the term and think in terms of sustainable agriculture. Okay? And they have a certain image and notion about what that is. Agriculturalists, at least conventional agriculturalists, want to think and use the term agricultural sustainability. And if you'll allow me a little bit of editorial license, and I'll try to be fair to both sides. The notion is that this is an agriculture that's going to be modified in ways that so that it can be that it could be considered as sustainable agriculture. On the other hand, this is an agriculture that will be shaped on occasion when a problem is needed so as to maintain its sustainability. Now, he argues in the book, and I think he's absolutely right, that if these two groups were finally to agree that these two notions were one and the same thing, then at least those two groups could get together, and perhaps then they could form a coalition, have dialogue and so forth, so that the general topic of sustainability in agriculture and wherever could move forward. But at the moment, this is, in other words, so this is taking the current system, tweaking it when necessary to keep it going on and on. This is basically taking the current system, modifying it fairly drastically, but in the process, hopefully getting it to a point where it would be indefinite.
Which category is no-till agriculture?
It actually can fit into both. It can fit into both. And I'll get into a couple of these little things again. It's more sustainable than full-till, but it's still there's still some things that could be done and some problems that it presents for it to be totally sustainable. Actually, the key question in the whole notion of sustainable agriculture, sustainable development, and as one might be trying to formulate some kind of a policy, is who and what do we want to sustain? And now I'll go through these and you'll get some notion, I think, of how this all fits out. First of all, I need to have some notion about when I use the word farm program, I'm not going to ask you how many of you know what it means. What I'm going to ask you is what comes to your mind when the term farm program is used. What do you think of when you hear farm program?
Payments.
Pardon?
Support payments.
Okay. Subsidies. Same thing.
Yeah. Export program.
The export program. That's a bit different. What else?
Irrigation programs.
Yeah, same, somewhat the same thing, but depending on what part of the country you're from, that's right. There's if you're in California, you would know about those, I would think.
REA?
REA, yeah, actually it's in there, although lots of times anymore it's not necessarily included in the farm bill, but it's certainly part of the whole USDA operation.
Define.
Pardon?
Define.
Rural Electrification Administration.
Oh,
it's the program that
CRP would be in.
That put light into the country.
Set-asides
are in some sense tied to the commodities, but the CRP is the other sort of basic or kind of different kind of component in which you actually have a conservation, an effort that's aimed at promoting conservation. So basically what you have in these kinds of things, the farm program, in one case, you have efforts that are aimed at enhancing farm income, okay? The subsidy payments, okay? Another one what you have is, to the extent that you can do it, you would have programs that would try to reduce production, because then the prices would go up, and then the marketplace would take care of the increased income. The government wouldn't have to do it. And by and large, those fail miserably in the United States, because what happens is that people get paid to take 10 or 15 or 20% of their production out of production, and they just apply those inputs in a more intensive fashion to the rest of the acres, and they end up producing almost as much as if they grew them up. So lots of people are catching on now that production controls and so forth don't work, even if they are perhaps conceptually valid. You have the income, you have the possibility of trying to modify the production, you have the notion of things like CRP, in which you want to actually promote conservation. Initially, the notion of the Conservation Reserve Program was that we were going to take fragile land out of production, and we're going to put it into 10-year lease kind of thing and so forth, and get that. What had to happen ultimately in order to get the thing passed is that you had to add to it the notion that in the process of taking these fragile lands out of production, a few people were fooled into the fact that this could also be another tool to control or reduce production, and so they bought it, even though they weren't really particularly interested in the conservation part of it, but because it looked like it might do something for prices, they went along. Let's see, anything else in the farm? Oh yeah, there's a whole other thing in the farm program that, pardon? No, go ahead. There's a whole other thing in the farm program that actually makes it go, and from a political point of view. You know what I'm talking about? I thought you said entitlements, and you're getting close.
The food stamp program?
Food stamp program. That's all part of it, and that's what this and this is all about over here on this side. The coalition that's among Democrats in particular, but a lot of the farm thing has been pretty much bipartisan. Take farm state congressmen and urban congressmen, particularly ones with high levels of need for food stamps, and those two groups together can pretty much, with a little bit of horse trading and so forth, get a farm bill passed in the past. That coalition is right now very vulnerable because there's a number of new players in Washington, and they're not interested in either the farm state or the urban situation, and so it's going to be a tougher situation. Okay, let's move on. I talked about the conservation program. There also were times when, and there has been plans for cost sharing with regard to conservation kinds of programs, and so earlier on when we did a lot of terrace and in some cases dam construction and various kinds of things like that, there was a cost sharing program so that farmer paid part of the cost, but so did the government. So did we, that is. And I argue that that's a defensible sort of thing to do. We're going to talk about trying to conserve, take care of soil, which is a natural resource, which in that sense, that definition we all own. And so, in fact, it's not inappropriate for us to all make contributions to conserving it as well. Okay. So, go here. Now, I want to ask you this question. Does or did your family have a farm? How many can answer that person?
How many generations back?
I don't care.
Oh, wow.
Well,
Now, well, then let's make it a little bit more specific. Within the last, one that you were able to physically connect with. So how do you, given that, how do you define family farm? You hear a lot about one of the purposes ultimately of the farm program is to save the family farm. Haven't you heard that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what I'll tell you is that the current family farm, I can't think of many things worse than the current farm bill with regard to saving the family farm. I can't think of many things that we could do that would hasten its demise more than the current, well, the last three or four farm bills, not just the current one. So what do you think of as a family farm? What are the two or three or four defining qualities of a family farm?
Run by one family.
Run by one family. Okay.
It's actually tilled and operated.
Owner operated.
Yeah, owner operated. Okay. Produces enough to sustain that family with a reasonable income.
Okay,
that's in conflict with the first one, but another definition.
Yeah, that's at least an aspiration for certain. I don't know that might be going a bit beyond the definition and sort of put into the aspiration goal, but it's still part of what a lot of people think of.
It's different than what we think of. We've all heard the stories of India, say, where generation after generation have carved this plot into smaller and smaller chunks, and yet continue to expect it to support that population. The farm that I'm thinking of in eastern Washington, mm-hmm. the population of people on the land is a little bit less than a generation ago. Mm-hmm. My cousin farms what supported three families a generation ago.
Okay.
So that's a lot less.
Yeah.
Now, and you may not know the answer to this, but do we have some notion about, on the one hand, that farm supported three families a generation ago. How many families did it feed then, and how many families does it feed now? Is there a reversal in the numbers and the trends with regard to how many it feeds as compared to how many it supports?
You mean the same number of tilled acres?
Yes. Well, the farm as a unit, and it could be, it's probably bigger than what it was then.
But basically what I'm saying is that my cousin can tell me who owned this land, and mm-hmm. it was this uncle and this and so on. And so he has three people's land, and mm-hmm. Some of it's irrigated now. It used to be dry land wheat, so okay. Naturally he's producing more.
He's feeding more people now than the three of them did a generation ago.
But even without the irrigation, which would make it a major difference, they would probably still be producing more.
Yeah, and what's the reason for that, basically?
New varieties.
Well, I didn't pay him to say that. That's one, but there's some others.
More fertilizer.
How did it happen that it took three uncles and aunts, where they just only worked a third as hard then as they do now? How
they're cultivated now.
Mechanization.
Okay. In fact, what we're really talking about is that over the last generation, a whole lot of capital, or capital kinds of things, whether it's purchase inputs of one kind or another, have been used to supplant human labor. Okay? And that's why you can get more, one person can get more done, because there's less labor involved, but there's much more capital involved.
Yeah, but 1 acre can get a whole lot more too, whether it's one person or not.
Yeah, but part of that's because, again, in some cases, what we're doing is to substitute capital-intensive things for labor-intensive things. And a good example of that would be weed control. you can affect, one person can accomplish, for the most part, not necessarily well in one way, but one person can accomplish much. We control for many more acres today than they could a generation ago, because a generation ago, or a little longer than that, you had to cultivate if you're growing row crops. Wheat's a little different situation. Today, you basically, cultivators in some cases are lost items almost. In any event, much less labor is required to get the same number of area covered.
So they substituted the petroleum-driven tractors for draft animals.
Sure.
To land to feed the animals and hay. And
all of the above. And now, because I can, it makes sense to do it now instead of later. So what has that done for the rural communities and the rural population?
Decimated, totally. Mm. Nothing more than the CRP.
Actually, it's, in some sense, it's had its negative impact has, I think, been much more than the positive impact of CRP, as good as that may have been.
No, I mean to decimate the population.
Oh, yeah. Actually, the CRP, I think if it were allowed to go on a little bit more, and if we thought in a little bit different terms, more creatively, we might end up with some new land uses because of increased wildlife, recreation,
tourism.
Possibilities and tourisms and so forth, that we might end up with not a different amount of people in the community. But certainly if we think only in terms of agriculture as being the primary source of revenue, CRP is going to depopulate the
community. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell that to the dealer, to the implement dealer.
Well, I understand. That person is not the only player in the game, but you're right, absolutely right. Okay, now, we mentioned a little bit about size, and obviously we had a Secretary of Agriculture who was also a bee, Mr. Butts, a few years ago, who made a number of proclamations, but one of them was that bigger was better. He also said something to the effect, let's see if I can find it. He's not my favorite person. Unfortunately, when I was at Purdue, he wasn't there, so he couldn't get even with me. Basically what he said was that if we switch to organic production, we would lose the effect of a large number of producers as far as production is concerned. Even if we just switch to what could be called sustainable agriculture. Lots of people think in those terms because at the time he was thought of for a lot of people as an expert, but basically the kinds of things he had to say now turn out to be not really on target. At the same time, I would argue that automatically smaller equaling more sustainable is probably not something that can be at the moment proven or totally defensible as well. My notion is that there's a different kind of criteria for sustainability, and in one sense it doesn't have to do with size of farms, and because there's a lot of emotion associated with size of farms, I would rather move over to this kind of a situation as far as sustainability is concerned. I would say, regardless of the size, there are two issues that we need to be concerned with. One of them has to do with the stewardship of non-renewable resources. And I'm thinking of petroleum, I'm thinking of fossil fuels, I'm thinking of water, I'm thinking of land, I'm thinking of air. If the system is a good steward of those resources, but for the most part they are non-renewable, they regenerate at an incredibly slow pace. Paint dries much, much faster than these resources regenerate. But they all do regenerate in some way. So that's the first criteria. And the second criteria, and by the way, when we talk about sustainability with regard to agriculture, I usually don't get any quarrels with this one. This one's really kind of hard to debate. But the next one I do get debaters. I also say that a system is will not be sustainable in the long run if the system contributes to widening of the gap between the have and the have-nots. And that current conventional agricultural system clearly has done that. And that's why I said one of the worst things that can happen in one sense to the small family-sized farms is the current farm bill and the ones. Now, because as we come down here under cost of production guarantee, people have a notion that if we were to guarantee the cost of production in agricultural systems, that the small person could then be protected and that we would take care of saving the family farm. Well, first of all, there's a whole number of things that are, that really put that into the mythical category. One of them is whose cost? Because if you take 100 farms, they have 100 different costs. Buzz earlier, a couple of times, like Buzz Kahn, I've heard him say, he's not here right now, but I've heard him say, I'm living with him, that if you have two Jewish people present, you have three opinions. Well, in this case, if you have 100 producers, you'll have at least 100 costs of production. So are you going to guarantee individually each one's cost of production? Well, the operation of that is a nightmare. What's going to happen is if you take the average cost on the whole, there is a scale associated with the cost of production, and typically, at least up to a certain level anyway, the cost of production, at least per unit of production, goes down up to a certain level. What?
Of a certain level of what?
Of size. Yeah. And so, in fact, if you were to operate on that basis, and the small people would be put at a relatively strong comparative disadvantage, and it wouldn't save the family farm, it would send it down sooner. So now, you can talk about capping, and there's lots of talk about that. We've even tried it a time or two. One of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons why it doesn't work. One of them is that there's all kinds of maneuvering that can go on, so that if you need to, you can find three dogs, if necessary, that can own part of that land, and as a result, you can split those payments up to the point you can keep them under the cap. The other reason that doesn't work is that heretofore, any kind of payments that we were talking about, we were also trying to tie with production control. Now, in this country, 15% of the farmers produce 85% of the production. Okay. Now, if you're going to have a program that's going to do all these things, you're going to have it structured in such a way that you include some of the big people. Otherwise, you're not going to have any impact on the production control. Okay. And so what we did was to compromise the need for income enhancement by also wanting to be able to tap into some of those big guys who, and unless they modified their production, we weren't going to have any effective production control. And so we had to compromise. And as a result, that's the other argument, that's political argument, that use that capping won't work. Now, if you could decouple the notion of income support on the one hand, and actually shed this whole notion of production control, which doesn't work, and that could eliminate at least part of this dilemma. But to date, we haven't done that. And again, even back to the CRP thing, we tried to satisfy the goal of conservation on the one hand, but we also sold the program to some people on the basis that it would lower production. And again, that's how they bought in. So you have that kind of a thing. I've already suggested in this that agriculture in rural communities, rural America, is not the same thing. And the problem is that when we talk about governmental policy, we aim it at agriculture, and rural America gets that too, even though it isn't really suited for it. In some cases, it's horribly counterproductive for rural America, if in fact it is at least on the surface, something that appears good for agriculture. So we have this kind of problem. Yeah, I've already given you this answer. And this is something that is another little problem. We talk about if we were to move to something that's more sustainable, less energy and less capital intensive and so forth, that the cost of food would go up. Well, you know, when less than 10% of the cost of the food that you buy gets to the farmer, you know, if you doubled the farmer's share, or doubled the part that the cost associated with that sort of thing, relatively speaking, isn't going to change the price of food very much if all the other costs aren't marginalized out, but of course they are. So whenever something goes up 5 cents and everybody else just applies a percentage to it, and that's when it gets to be big. Not because there's that much more money going to the farmer. It's now down to 10%, and if it continues, here's what the chart looks like. The one in the middle that's getting squeezed is the farm. Actually, it's not because of the inputs, the capital intensive inputs. They're growing, but not like, here's what's growing. Marketing. It started out at about 50%, and it's now almost 80% of your food cost. Marketing being a lot of things, transportation, storage, and that sort of thing. Cost primarily associated with marketing and processing, it should be. Cost primarily associated after the commodity leaves the farm gate. So that's something you need to be aware of. Here's another one, and some of you might quarrel with this. That's why, instead of drawing a slash through the equal, I just put a question mark there, be a little bit softer. Organic equals, or does it, safe?
Or safer.
Or safer, either way. Well, how many of you think that I should remove that question mark?
That presumes that conventional is unsafe.
Yeah, well, you can presume anything you want. Well, I'm going to take a poll right now. How many of you think that I should remove that black question mark in this one right here?
Are you talking about food products that are brought to the public that are pesticide-free or...
Organic means...
Is that what you
pesticide-free,
mean?
Fertilizer-free, synthesized products involved.
But otherwise, taken care of in the marketing system, they're brought to you by refrigeration and so on.
Right. All the other stuff is more or less the same.
Yeah. I don't like the word safe, but if you wrote safer...
Okay, well, then safer.
That helps me say no.
Okay. Do I remove the question mark now?
Yes.
Why?
Pesticides removed, that would make a huge difference.
Oh, yeah, it will make them safer, there's no doubt about it. But is it possible that there are some organisms which might not be there that are now there,
because you did.
Which are equally dangerous to pesticides on the food materials? Some diseases whatever and so forth. So it isn't automatic. My point is, it's not automatic that because it's organic, it's safer. Yeah.
Dr. Ames, who developed the Ames test for carcinogenics, would dispute that. He would say that it's known that pesticides residues are infinitesimally a problem.
You mean they're always? There is no level at which they're not a problem?
No. He said that.
Which Ames are you talking about?
Dr. Ames.
Bruce Ames?
Yeah. Maybe the Ames test.
I think you might want to take another look at.
That's what I read. That's what
my said. My notion is that he's gone, in fact, totally the other way recently.
Well, it's very recent then, if it has.
Well, relatively recent. Well,
State what he says. What Ames says.
I think he's now at a point of basically, you know, the Delaney Amendment within the whole food legislation and so forth basically says the notion is that you will try to deal with every level of residue, pesticide residue. Well, what's happened, Delaney Amendment, I think it was written in 1957 or 1960 or something like that. And the instrumentation that we have now to detect residues compared to then is, you know, orders of magnitude more sensitive. And so what we can detect today, nobody knew the kinds of numbers that were involved, yet it's residue. And what most of Bruce Ames' arguments, as I would understand them, is that those levels, even though they're detectable, are now well below the danger level. And so that there isn't any. Okay, we're on the same.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's what he said, there's no problem.
No, yeah.
It's blown out of proportion to what there's no.
Yeah, and
these tests are based on the very questionable assumption that it's totally a linear phenomenon.
Yeah, well, all those sorts of things. But the main thing ultimately is actually the sensitivity of the test. It is now, where we could find dollar bills before, we can now find pennies. And maybe it's at the level of 50-cent pieces where there's a problem, but below 50-cent pieces, it's detectable, but it won't necessarily be toxic to human or to human beings. That's the general argument. Well, what about, is organic sustainable? In the sense of, does it meet both of those criteria?
It can still be mining the soil.
And the water. Depends on what you're growing and whether it should be growing in that location or not.
Depends how you cultivate.
How do you control all the organisms that are going to destroy it?
Well, there are natural methods, rotation of crops and other things like my dad did in the early days.
But they're still pests.
Yeah. Some of those work. Obviously, they make the problem less in some cases, maybe below the threshold of particular damage. But I think the notion of the mining of the soil, at least under a number of particular organic operations, it's likely that it's going to mine the soil. Now, if you have a huge supply of manure and you have manure for maybe 20 of your neighbors, although that's totally unrealistic anymore because there aren't 20 people in some kind of an area that have livestock anymore. But if they did,
they should be using it themselves anyway.
Well, true, but don't complicate things. Likely that there's a mining situation going on, and as a result, if that's the case, in one sense, we're not really being totally perfect or good stewards of the resource in terms of the soil situation, and in particular the petroleum. Let me move quickly. Nonpoint pollution, I've already told you kind of what it is. What we're talking about, in effect, is movement of soil. And that in itself would be a serious problem as far as water is concerned, sediment and so on. Those of you who know something about Eastern Washington, my sense is that the current farming practices that go on in Eastern Washington in the pools, particularly when they raise winter wheat, they might last 50 years.
Before there's
not going to be. I mean, you get landslides of 100, 200, 300 feet wide, 2-3 feet deep, and in this dimension equal to the one in this dimension, to the point that you couldn't get a tractor and an implement through it. And I've seen them, I was only here for 2 or 3 days a couple of years ago in Eastern Washington, but they're not rare phenomena. Or you can go to the streams, surface water streams, and I understand that dredging those streams is soon going to be an annual, if not more than that, operation that's going to have to take place just to kind of keep those waterways even semi-functional.
Well, why they don't terrace around here? I mean, contour.
Well, I think there's actually, in one sense, for the moment, even an easier solution than that. most of the rainfall in that part of the state occurs, as I understand it, like in November, December, January, and perhaps into February, at least in that general part of the time. And if they had stubble in the field at that time, instead of having tilled it in the fall and planted winter wheat, the soil would be much less vulnerable to erosion when the water comes. But because winter wheat yields more than spring wheat does, they want to grow the winter wheat instead of the spring wheat. And when I was there a couple of years ago, I asked him what I think ultimately was interpreted as heresy. How much money for dredging will it take before you could take that same money, pay it to the farmers to grow spring wheat instead of winter wheat, and get the same kind of benefit? That is, you wouldn't have to dredge the waterways. The farmers would get the same income.
Who's doing the dredging?
What?
The taxpayers doing the dredging?
Well, who do you suppose?
Yeah.
And
well,
why
isn't
the
soil
farmer doing it then?
And you'd have the soil stay on the field.
Yeah.
It's not
farmers are never going to have to do it, because in some cases the waterway is 5 or 10 miles from the farm. And furthermore, how do you know which farm?
Nice.
You don't tag the soil, so you can't. That's what this non-point pollution is all about. You don't tag the soil. But it's not just
the soil. Yeah.
You don't tag the soil. You can't tell whose it is. What?
How would you propose to do that?
I think there's easier ways to deal with the problem.
Lots
but
of ways to do
the problem is not just the soil. But typically when the soil goes, there's usually been pesticides and or fertilizers incorporated into soil, and they go too. So you're not just getting the soil sediment, but you're getting actually some of these synthesized chemicals getting into the waterway as well.
Going back to this non-till farming though, I've heard that it takes less energy. You know, you don't have to plow the ground, but it also produces less too.
Sometimes, some situations. But typically have more weeds, have more diseases, more insects, because in fact, the whole reason for plowing is to take the stubble and all the other stuff and tip it over and get it buried so that it won't interfere with and won't come into contact with the next year's crop. And if you don't do that tillage, there is going to be that contact. And so if you don't rotate or whatever, you're going to have problems. And so in some cases what happens is people no-till, then they have to go in and do a fairly intensive herbicide program to deal with the weeds that they didn't deal with in the tillage operation. Now, it doesn't have to be done that way, but that's one of the possibilities unless you know what you're doing and end up
trying to herbicides, things. Whether they plow or not?
Pardon?
Will they all use herbicides, whether they plow or not?
Different ones and different amounts.
It all depends. It depends on what the problem is. Depends on how big the problem is. The herbicides are not free. So if you don't have to use them, most people, I mean, they might like their herbicide or fertilizer dealer, but they're not going to get money if they don't really need to. At least the good ones will. Okay, we got a couple more here to go. We already talked about this political coalition. The key players in farm policy, who did they used to be? Or what states did they used to come from? If we looked at the congressional situation, where did the members of the House and Senate Ag Committee come from?
Farm states.
Well, don't leave this state out. Mr. Foley was chairman. Congressman Foley, before he assumed the speaker's chair, was chairman of the House Ag Committee for a number of years. Illinois, farm states of various kinds. Well, how many congressmen today, Congress people, consider themselves to be farm congressmen? And there's a way to kind of measure that. It depends upon, in your district, how much of the income in your district comes from farming. How many congressmen? There's 435, right?
Right.
Something like that. Congressmen. How many of them by that definition of having, I think it's 20% of their district's income from farming. How many of them are agricultural congressmen? How many do you think?
Well, I figure you just look at this state, and you figure Eastern Washington has two seats in the House.
Okay.
And, Western Washington, give them maybe one or two of them that would think they were agricultural.
Okay.
If you include forestry.
Not in this, not no. In this ballgame.
Yeah.
They can be key players, but not in this ballgame. It's another game.
Yeah.
Another bill, another time.
Yeah. Different two congressmen out of Washington's in 90.
Well, yeah. How many think it's less than half?
Yeah.
Okay. How many think it's less than a third? And that would be 104.
Yes.
Well, how many think it's less than 100, period?
Yes.
Probably.
How many think it's less than 75?
Yes.
Now remember, 75 is about 18%.
Oh, that'd be about right.
20%. How many think it's 50 or less, which would be almost down to 10%?
Maybe 1/9.
Hmm?
Maybe 1/9.
Yeah, not quite. A little bit more than 10%.
Now your definition was 20% of their constituents are farmers.
No, 20% of the income. Of the income, 20% of the economy in their district comes from agriculture.
Yeah, okay.
Oh.
Why don't you just tell us?
50. Less than 50, actually. Now, how many does it take to get a bill passed in the House of Representatives? Even if Mr. Gingrich is in charge, or even when he is, it takes 200 and about 220. So where are those 50 going to go to get the other 170 votes? That they need? Yeah, but we, you know, the lot of the people who are in this Congress now, they don't have as much support, sympathy, whatever, for a number of the urban areas that previous Congresses.
You don't even know people have to eat.
Well, yeah, where does education come in regards to the whole food chain problem compared to the immediate dollar? I mean, what kind of, that's the problem, huh?
You bet.
What was the question?
The education. We still have the old farm state congressman. Are there any new, do you think there's any new players with regard to farm policy developments and so forth? If you just were to kind of think about
the conservation.
Yeah, conservation, environmental. Now, the problem is, okay, they speak the same language, but they don't mean the same thing. And they're a long ways from the same bet.
Yeah.
Even though the words are almost the same. They're still a long ways from the same minute.
Yeah, the second one, the agricultural sustainability, often means to the ag people enough dollars.
Linear extension of the current situation. Tweak it a little bit here and there, but just keep it going. Now, that's particularly what the environmentalists would say, and the agriculturalists would say, well, yeah, we can go back to the horse and buggy days and whatever and so forth, production of dropped by a half, and you create a real big mess. Even though we use basically the same words. I can tell you, I've been trying in some sense to be in both camps, and
rejected by both?
Well, depends. No, not loved by all, let's put it that way. We're getting close. I want to give you, I'd like for the four of you just join into one group here and assume for the moment that you have the same congressman, and then why don't you turn around and join this thing behind you. You've got the same congressman, and one, two, three, four of you have the same congressman, and then if you will join those three back there, you've got the same congressman. Now, You've got about 5 minutes, which isn't very long to be short. I always try to do this so that there's more time. But I want you to just talk about, given these or any other items that you think should be included in a conversation, about what kind of advice you're going to send to your congressman or woman to when they have to vote on important farm legislation. You can talk either about goals, or you can talk about specific legislation, or whatever you want, but I'd just like you to have a little conversation about what you would want to convey, so that you have the undivided attention of your congressperson for at least 15 minutes.